OWC Radio number 50 with special guest, fellow podcaster, Guy Searle. I am Tim Robertson, and this is OWC Radio, episode number 51. Thanks very much for downloading this episode. I appreciate it. And I do have a special guest for this episode. His name is Guy Searle. Now, here's the thing. Usually when I have someone on OWC and I'm doing an interview, chances are I haven't met that person before, in person or otherwise. Now, I do have some reoccurring guests, like the last episode, I had Peter Cohen on the show. I've had Steve Sandy on OWC Radio 3 or 4 times now. And I know them, and I've actually met them in person. But that's still a little bit different than my guest today. Guy Searle is the host of the MyMac podcast.
Co-host.
Co-host of the MyMac podcast. And, you know, I want to... Siri just beeped at me. That's weird. Let me turn off Siri up there. In fact, Siri, I'm reading Siri back. Thanks very much for downloading this episode. I appreciate it. I do not have a special guest. It's been recording me for a while now. let's turn that off, okay?
Hey, Siri.
Hey, Siri. And then it just started recording. Guy Searle and I have been podcast partners in the past. Our histories are intertwined going back, a decade now?
Oh, more than that. 2001, I think, 2000. Is when I started writing for MyMac.
Yeah, so this is somebody I've known for a very long time. He's one of my best friends. We've spent nights in hotels together.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up.
It's true. We have. Once. Yeah. And then I immediately got another room. That was at a Macworld Expo when we were covering the Macworld Expo as part of MyMac.com. So, Guy, welcome to OWC Radio.
Thank you, Tim. I feel welcome.
One of the longest intros ever right there. I thought it would be fun. Look, we've podcasted together for many years, and off. I've had you on TechFan. You've had me on MyMac, most recently the 500th weekly episode of that podcast, and that was 6 months ago or so?
Yeah.
Or longer.
Much longer than that.
Was it?
We're on 570. We just did 573, I think, or 573.
Wow, really?
Yeah. Jeez. Can you believe, so that means it's been about a year and a half.
Wow, okay. Wow. It doesn't seem like it was that long. But all this time, Guy and I have done all these different podcasts together. I've never actually interviewed Guy. Did you realize that? I've never actually interviewed you.
Well, I'm so free and open with the kind of person that I am that people going in pretty much already know who I am.
I already said that we had a hotel room together, Guy.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, some people can't take the manliness.
I tell you.
That's kind of how it works.
So let's back up a little bit.
Okay.
Guy Searle is in high school. What did Guy Searle want to be when he became an adult?
To live to be an adult. I actually grew up, for people who don't know me that well, I grew up in South Florida, in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, Oakland Park, if you want to be exact. And Oakland, I'm about 10 years older than you, Tim. I just turned 55 years old on, September 9th, which was the same day as the Apple event. Awful nice of Apple to arrange that for me.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Tim. Tim Cook is what I meant. And there were a lot of both legal and semi-illegal temptations to deal with having grown up in South Florida in the 70s. So when I was a teenager, I really didn't think at all about the future much beyond how I was going to get to the beach that weekend.
You're a day-to-day guy.
Well, in a lot of ways, I still am, and drives my wife Tracy crazy. But that's kind of the kind of person that I am.
Do you think that's a South Florida thing, a product of your environment growing up there, or do you think that that's just kind of who you are?
I blame my father because he was very much the same way.
Was he? So it's genetics.
Yeah.
I don't know, though. You know, listen, you say that. Well, okay, never mind. Go on.
I was just, my dad was very old as compared to most fathers. And it's a whole long story on how that happened. But he was 50 years old when I was born.
That's pretty old to become a new father.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, my mother was 43. I was very much one of those times when, you know, the woman comes out of her OBGYN office going, "I'm what? What?" And yeah, so my mother was 43 years old when I was born. As a matter of fact, I was actually born during Hurricane Donna in September of 1960. Now, I don't remember much about it because I was very young at the time. But having grown up in an environment like that where my parents were at least a generation older than most of the other kids that were my age, it was really, really different. And it used to actually drive my father insane because when kids would come over to the house for the first time, he'd come out, you know, "Hey, how you doing? Blah, blah, blah." And inevitably, one of the kids would say, "Oh, is that your grandpa?" And as soon as they would say that, the blood would boil and the steam would come out of the ears. "Oh, I'm his father, damn it." Yeah, and then the kids would leave and never return. But it was still, you know, it basically meant that I had a full complement of new friends all the time.
So you didn't really think about what you were going to do when you grow up. Could you imagine that broadcasting in any form would have had something to do with it? Or writing, for that matter?
I've always loved writing. Writing was something that I had a passion for, even as a relatively young child. My mother kept these little, you know, one-page stories that I would write. I have no idea where they are now. But she would keep those, and I found them, I guess, when I was in my early 20s. And I was like, "Oh, who wrote this stuff?" And, you know, my mom kind of looked at me and said, that was you.
You had no memory of it.
No memory of it whatsoever. So, and technology was very different between, and it's one of those things where you see how technology has advanced in really a very, very short amount of time. In the 70s, nobody thought that they would have a desktop computer. A computer was this big monstrous thing that was in a warehouse someplace that was, you know, if it ever got sentience, was going to take over the world. That was just the way things were. And then when the 80s came along, and it really wasn't until like the early mid 80s when I really realized that technology was, and computers in general, was something that was upcoming and was going to be a thing in my time. And it was kind of odd because I moved, and well, actually, this is very odd. I moved from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, to Akron, Ohio, which all in itself is very odd. But I was living in this apartment building, and my neighbor called me over, and I went over, and he had an Apple II, I want to say an Apple IIe. It was one of the green screen.
Oh yes,
Apple IIs.
Yep.
And he was playing this flight simulator, and it would refresh the screen like every other second kind of thing. So, you know, we're not talking about, you know, "Oh, wow, look at the little people on the ground." It was more like, "Wow, there's a large rectangular thing that is represents a building." But it was like the first time that I had actually seen a computer and seen what a computer could do. And I was instantly fascinated. Now, I was already working in technology, but in on the security side. I've worked in security electronics going all the way back to about 1981, and it's served me very well. And that's been my gig for, God, 35 years. How depressing is that?
That's how you make your mortgage payment.
Yeah, and even better, the house will be paid off in about 2 years.
Yeah, so that's awesome.
That really makes me happy. So, but that was like the first time that I actually saw computers.
So,
and yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask, I wanted to stop you there for a minute because it's easy to kind of skip over how fast the computer revolution happened.
Yeah.
And I don't know if people who are younger than you and I really get it. Look how long the bronze... Well, look how long the Bronze Age lasted. Right?
Yeah, 1,500 years.
Right. I mean, human civilization for the first 2,000 years has only sped up towards the end in a significant way. For the first 1,000 years, going back 2,000 years, for the first 1,000 years, things didn't really change all that much.
Yeah, and especially from generation to five, and then you die.
Right, especially from generation to generation. But once we hit the 20th century, that's when everything kind of changed. The Industrial Revolution really did change everything.
Oh yeah.
But that was even slow compared to the computer, the information age.
Oh yeah. It's amazing. Take airplanes for example. According to most history books, the first airplane flew in North Carolina by the Wright brothers in 1904.
I think so. 1908 or 1904?
Maybe. It was either 1904 or 1907. I always get those two mixed up. I don't know why.
Well, you know what we could do? It would be really cool if we had some like technology that we could. Right, Siri.
I'm sorry, I missed that.
Oh, let me try it again. When did the Wright brothers fly?
Brothers fly.
1903.
Yeah, I just looked that up.
You know, it doesn't do that beep anymore. I'm holding down the button and it doesn't go doo-doo.
Oh, have you already updated to 9?
Yeah, I was going to get to that later.
Okay. Yeah, we'll talk about that later.
Okay, thank you, Siri.
Thanks, Siri. So 1903, the first official heavier-than-air flight.
Right.
You know, there were balloons and dirigibles and all the rest of those, but this was the first heavier than air flight.
Yep.
And there were biplanes for the most part until, I mean, that's
right before World War II.
World War II, everybody was flying biplanes.
And it wasn't until the 50s that we had reliable air travel that could get you from one side of the United States to the other, or let alone across the world, across an ocean.
Yes.
So roughly 50 years before we had transatlantic, transpacific flight.
That was relatively safe.
Right.
Yeah.
And let's be honest, air travel hasn't changed a whole lot since the 50s.
Well, it's gotten faster and the planes have gotten bigger.
Well, it got faster up until about the 90s and then we've kind of leveled off. They don't go any faster than they did it back in the 90s.
That's true, but
you know why? It's because we decided that was good enough,
and it was cost effective.
Yeah, so it's good enough and it's cost effective. But the computer industry guy didn't follow that. It's never fast enough. It's never good enough.
The difference, I think, has been the miniaturization
and
of
the
electronics
cost.
And the cost.
Yep.
When I first started working in electronics, there were lots of discrete components. You had resistors, capacitors, diodes, transistors, you know, all that stuff that you would actually take a meter and measure the amount of voltage through it to figure out where the problem lied within one of these discrete components. And nowadays, it's like, okay, I think the board is bad. Let me try this one. Oh, that didn't do it. Let's try this one. Okay, it's fixed. In the meantime, the two boards that you took out, toss them.
Yep.
So, Swaptronics. That's what I've called it, Swaptronics. So, I think we are starting to get to the point where I think technology, especially computer technology, is getting ready to kind of shift. We went from Moore's Law, where every 18 months the speed of computer processors would essentially double. And then they kind of hit a brick wall because they couldn't squeeze the miniaturized little magic bits together close enough to make them faster. So then they started working on making them smaller.
Well, smaller and adding multiple processors.
More cores, right.
Which makes them faster.
More processor and then more processors, within a particular computer.
Right.
But for a long time, it didn't really matter that much if you had multiple cores, because most operating systems and most software didn't know what to do with it. You know, I had a 933 G4. But it wasn't a Mac Pro. It was the Quicksilver Tower.
Power Mac.
And
how quickly forget.
I know. It's still in the closet over there. The I can't remember. There was some company. It wasn't OWC. It was a different company.
Yeah, the processor upgrade. Oh.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a time that you could upgrade your processor in your computer. You don't really do that anymore.
No, because there's not really that much of a point. You get more speed out of things like
Thunderbolt,
adding an SSD,
yeah,
putting in more RAM. You know, it's almost the reverse of the old argument about discrete components. Now instead of putting in a faster processor or adding more cores or all the rest of that, you start worrying about the peripherals that tie into both the operating system and the processor, because you try to find where the bottleneck is. What is it that is slowing my system down? Go ahead.
Well, the thing is, when you started writing at MyMac 2001,
yeah,
you were waiting for that computer to do things. You'd click, yes, and you'd wait. And so adding a faster processor made a huge difference.
Yes.
And all the peripherals were slow no matter what.
Right.
Then we had that shift where we got faster peripherals. We got the Thunderbolt, now Thunderbolt 2, and USB-C coming out. And we've got all these faster things. And that was fast back then for the time, like SCSI and SCSI 3 and all that. But not like it is today.
No.
So we have these peripherals that are so much faster. And that's kind of where our concentration is, because the processor, we're not waiting on it anymore. Look, there's still things that we have to wait on. If people are doing a lot of video rendering, for instance, the more speed they can get out of that machine, processor-wise, better.
Right.
But for 90% of people that are using computers right now, it's more you can't take advantage of the speed that the computer has. That wasn't true 20 years ago or 10 years ago.
No, it was not. And this kind of leads into, you know, where is the future of computing going? And I think it's telling that when Apple came out with the iPad Pro, which is I'll be picking one up. I'm still currently on a third generation iPad, which I had like the last time you went to a Macworld Expo.
Yeah.
Which I think was 2 or 3 years before it actually stopped.
No, I missed the last two.
Okay. Well, when you and I met at the last Macworld Expo that you went to, I had this iPad.
Yeah, I think that was 2012?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So after 4 years, yeah, it's time to upgrade that puppy a little bit. So but when Apple was doing the presentation for the iPad Pro, as they were talking about the specifications of it, one of the things that was said was that the ARM-based processor that the iPad Pro uses delivers desktop-class performance.
Well, if you go against cheap PCs, yes. It's not going to, and maybe even low-end Mac, it's not going to touch my MacBook Pro.
No, of course not, but it doesn't have to. Because, as you were saying just a little while ago, 90% of the people out there aren't using the full power of the computer that they currently have.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason why I think that this PC slowdown has been happening is that people are starting to realize that 2, 3, 4 year old computer, as long as they can keep the operating system updated, is plenty fast enough for what it is that they want to do every single day. My MacBook Pro is a 2009 model, 15-inch 2009 MacBook Pro. I picked it up for $400 off eBay, dropped in an SSD. It already had 8 gigs of RAM, and it's fine for the things that I use it for. Now, I'm not doing, you know, 4K video or the kinds of things that would require me to have a multiple processor, multiple core, either portable or desktop computer. The Mac Pro that I currently have is from 2008, and I've been doing a podcast on this beast ever since show 285, which is when Gaz and I took it over. And it's fine for all of the things that I do. I don't feel that sense of my computer is 2 years old, so therefore I should start saving my money to update it, because fortunately Apple makes pretty decent hardware and it doesn't really wear out that much. So as long as whatever OS that I'm currently using can be updated to the latest version and it'll run it relatively well, I don't really feel the need to update.
So you were in security. You saw I'm going back.
Okay.
You see your first home computer. What was the first computer that you bought?
The first computer that I actually bought was a Mac Plus in 1987.
Uh-huh.
And I paid...
too much money.
Yeah, $1,200. It was a 7.8 megahertz 68,000 Motorola processor. It had, I think, 2 megs of RAM, but it did have a SCSI. Port. So I went out at the same time. And that was $1,200 for that. Then I also bought a 40 meg hard drive for $750.
So you dropped $2,000 on that puppy.
Yeah, yeah, and I got that thing home and plugged in a drive, and I'm sitting there thinking, I will never fill this thing up.
Oh,
why
yeah.
did I get such a big drive? You know, now my the podcast that I do each week is bigger than the capacity of that drive.
Yeah, by about 50%. Each episode of My Mac that you release is in the 60 megabyte range.
Yeah, well, it's big.
Yeah.
You know, as compared to the stuff that you know we did back then. And I used that computer. Now, at the same time, I was traveling overseas, so for quite a bit of time, it was not being used. I had that for 7 years. I didn't update to my next computer until 1994, and there was a computer chain called CompUSA.
That's where I was going to say that's where I bought my first computer, but it wasn't.
Okay. But it's gone now.
I bought my first computer, believe this or not, at Walmart.
Really?
They had a sale. Well, they had a discontinuing thing. And I saw a Mac Performa 410 sitting there with a color monitor and a StyleWriter 2 printer for like $800. And
that was not a bad deal.
No, that was a really good deal because I had been researching, looking to get a Mac. I knew I wanted to get a Mac, and the nearest CompUSA that had Macs.
What year was that?
94.
Okay, so they were just in the process of starting to transition away from the 68X processors to PowerPC.
It was a couple of years later for that, but yeah. I mean, I got one of the worst machines, even when it was new, like a year and a half later. The funny thing is they had a Performa 405 in the box that cost $200 more, but yet I can get the 410. And look, as a newbie, 405 or 410, well, I want the 410.
Yeah, because it's five better.
It's five better. I will say this, though. Look, I got my start on that computer. I still have that computer, believe it or not. I don't have a monitor anymore for it, but I do have that computer. I think it's out in the shed.
Yeah.
That computer and that printer was awesome. It was amazing.
Yeah, I had some weird off Japanese brand dot matrix printer that was like just so freaking loud.
Mm.
It had
the StyleWriter 2 wasn't quiet, trust me.
Yeah, and it was like, I said something to print, and I would leave, like, the city so that I wouldn't have to hear it. But the actual next computer I bought, CompUSA, kind of started the whole store-in-store concept at the time. And they had they were trying to get rid of their PowerPC stuff because, sorry, they were trying to get rid of the 68X stuff because the PowerPC stuff was starting to come in.
Yep.
And they had a Performa 575, which was kind of one of the grandfathers of the original iMac, 14-inch color screen, CD burner, 800K, or no, 1.4, what was that floppy drive, the 1.4 meg floppy drive?
I know what you're talking about.
Okay, well, it doesn't matter. It had a floppy drive.
I'm actually looking at pictures of the StyleWriter, too. What a sexy little printer that thing was.
Yeah, there was absolutely nothing sexy about the printer I had.
This one was cool. I can't believe I wish I still had that, to be honest. It's just a nice-looking little printer.
Well, what did you replace it with?
Oh, hell, I don't know. It was black and white. It was slow. The ink was expensive. I don't remember even replacing it. I just know eventually it wasn't there anymore.
Well, if you Google Performa 575, you'll see the computer.
I knew the Performa 575 a lot. In fact, after I had bought my 410, maybe 6 months later, I was in CompUSA. I was looking for software because, remember, guy, back then, you had to go to the store to buy software.
Yep.
And as a Mac user, Walmart had gotten out of selling Macs, and that was the nearest store to me, so I had to go to Grand Rapids, Michigan. Actually, it was about an eighth of a mile away from the Apple store that you and I did the 100th episode of the My Mac podcast at.
Yeah, that mall.
Literally right across the street. Yep. They had a 575 there, and it was on sale, and oh, it was such a cool... It was awesome.
Yeah, they actually took that same design at the time and created the original Mac TV with it, except the case was black.
Yep. It was the same computer, except for the Mac TV had an actual TV tuner card in it.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was awesome.
There was an expansion slot in the 575. And that also because besides the 570, there was like the 570 series of computers.
Yep.
And I never went past the 575. Actually, and the next computer I bought after that was probably, and I know I'm hearing you groan even as I say this, was the first non-Apple Macintosh that I owned.
The UMAX?
UMAX. I had a UMAX C600, which was a 603E-based tower. Probably as far as working on it, the best Macintosh I have ever owned. Well put together, easy to work on. I actually updated the processor not long before I finally got rid of it to I think it was a 225 megahertz G3. So I went from a 603E to a G3.
Well, see, you had a big update. I went from my Performa to another Performa. A year later, I got the Performa 630.
Was that a tower?
No, unfortunately. But it had a CD-ROM in it, man.
Oh, well, so you were cooking with gas.
I remember there was this, I can't remember who made it now. But there was an expansion slot in the 630, and I bought this video card that I could plug my cable television in. You couldn't go full screen. It was just a tiny little window. But I could actually sit there and do work on my computer and have TV right up there in the corner of my screen. And it was a 15-inch monitor that I got with it, too, man. It was rocking.
Holy crap. Boy, how did you even use all that real estate?
Oh, 33 megahertz, you know... 4 megabytes of RAM, 250 gig hard drive. Man, that thing was awesome.
Well, do you remember the first terabyte hard drive you got?
No.
I do. And it was the same kind of feeling. You know, I'll never fill this thing up. But, you know, it doesn't really matter how much storage space that you get. You will find a way to fill it. It just doesn't matter. But I had two different clones because I liked the UMAX so much that I found a Motorola StarMax licensee that made a 604 based computer. I think it was APS Technology. Biggest piece of garbage I've ever owned in my life.
You know what? I'm wrong, dude. I'm misremembering my history. I don't think I ever got the 630. Because that didn't have an expansion in it. Not that I wouldn't, that I could have used for that video card. And the next one I bought was a tower that had the speakers built into it on the side. Remember that Mac monitor with the speakers kind of built into it?
Oh, yeah.
That's what I had. It was a Performa 6400. That's what my next one was. Okay, and it was a tower.
That is a tower.
Yes.
At one point I had two of them. I don't remember why. The G3 desktop, and it had the Wings output.
Oh, yes.
So it had composite video in and composite video out. So I could connect it up to like a VCR and output whatever silly little video that I had managed to coax the machine to make. And there was the software I used at the time was by a company called Strata, which I think is still in business.
Strata?
Yeah.
Yeah, they make 3D software.
Okay, well, they had a video editor that was multi-track, and it was the first multi-track video editor that I could afford. But it was, and I'm running it under OS 9, crashing like crazy. You know, I
don't believe that. Something under OS 9 crashing?
I know. It is so odd. I would do this intricate, you know, transition or whatever it was I was doing in the software, and I was sweating the entire time because I knew if I didn't save it, like, every 30 seconds, eventually OS 9 was going to crash and I was going to have to restart the computer and everything that I had done would be lost.
That was... saved. Oh. OS 9 days, OS 8, OS 7.5, 7.1.
Yeah.
Holding down the shift key to turn off extensions to try to figure out which one keeps crashing your Mac.
It's amazing that any of us continued to use these things.
And this one will make my machine look like a future Mac, so I'm going to install it. It's going to change the menus and the windows and everything. You remember those?
Oh, yeah. That started, I think that really started with System 8.
System 8 because everyone, because remember back in the day, System 8 was going to be 7. The next 6. Generation of the Mac OS.
Right.
You know, it's going to have, you know, threaded memory, protected memory, blah, blah, blah. Of course, it didn't. We didn't get that until OS 10. But Apple had released this preview of what it's going to look like, Mac OS 8. I still have the CD somewhere. It's a little quick time thing. And it showed, you know, the way the menus are going to look different, and the windows will look totally just bizarre, lollipop-looking stuff. And, of course, the first thing everyone did was, and it was called Copeland.
Yeah.
And the first thing everyone did, the software makers out there, was make a system extension to make it look like that. And, oh, my God, I loved it. I think the extension was actually called Copeland. And it was awesome, but, of course... It crashed all the darn time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, you know why they went to System 8, right? Instead of 7.6?
No, they went to 7.6. They didn't go to 7.7. There was a 7.6.
The reason why they went to 8 instead of 7.7
was
to kill the clone makers.
Yeah. Oh, I thought you were going to give me a corny pun.
No.
Because 7.8.9?
No. That's actually very true. Steve Jobs had come back to Apple, and he did not like the idea of other companies making Macs, mostly because Apple sales had pretty much tanked at that point.
Well, Apple was slow to change anything, and the clone makers were changing on a dime, making faster and faster and faster and sexier-looking boxes, and Apple simply couldn't keep up.
Yeah, that's very true.
You know, so the clone makers initially were supposed to expand the Mac market. They were supposed to concentrate their sales. No, not just the low end, but they were supposed to concentrate their sales wherever Apple was weak. And what they did instead is they competed directly against the Performa home lines against Apple and exactly the professional levels where Apple was making most of their money. the graphic design houses and stuff right. like that.
Yeah, the Centrists and Quadrilles.
Right. They were just eating into Apple's market share. They weren't expanding the market. So they didn't live up to their end of the agreement either.
Well, Apple ends up buying Power Computing. And because all of the clone makers, including their own close partner at the time, Motorola,
yep.
had licenses to release computers running System 7 all the way through the line. So when 7.7 was getting ready to be released, Jobs basically came in and said, okay, well, we'll just call it System 8, give it a few little tweaks as far as the way it looks goes, because there's really not that much of a difference between the last versions of System 7 and the original version of System 8.
Well, we thought so at the time.
Well, yeah, but, you know, we were young and stupid.
Yeah, well.
Young anyway. Or maybe just stupid. I don't know. Mm. But
a lot of things don't change, Guy. We're still we're still young.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. Good diplomatic answer there, Tim. So they released System 8, and that pretty much put the kibosh on all the clone makers. UMAX sold out their remaining stock and just left the business, and pretty much everybody else did too. And it's too bad because of... You know, there were basically just two of them that were making really, really nice, well put together, innovative designs, and that was Power Computing and UMAX. And I always wanted, they had their S series, or UMAX had their S line series, which was the 604 and higher machines. And it was just a gorgeous looking tower computer that I always wanted one. And
didn't it have those little dimples on it?
Yeah, and a little door that you would open up
that
had the CD-ROM drive.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And it was just beautiful. And then it all went away.
Well, I remember the CEO of Power Computing, because they didn't have a license to make a laptop. And Power Computing actually came out with a G3 laptop. And Apple wouldn't let them release it. And he actually marched it around to Macworld Expo New York, saying, see, this is what you could have, but Apple won't let us give it to you. That was like the last big hurrah.
That must have been 97.
Somewhere in there, yeah. At the time, you started attending the Apple Pi user group.
Yes, here in Washington, D.C., the Washington Apple Pi.
And that was, I assume, to get, you know, we're almost 40 minutes into this, so we have to get moving on this.
Oh, sorry.
And for those wondering, yes, I do have the three random questions for Guy. You started participating in the user group, and you were writing stuff for them as well, correct?
Yes, I was doing some product reviews, though I'm really not that good at doing product reviews, as you probably well know. I'm more of a kind of slice of life kind of writer, an opinion piece writer, than I am reviews. Reviews, honestly, and there are some people that are just great at it. I am not.
And that's how I found you, though, isn't it? It's something you had written for them?
Actually, no. The way that you and I first started communicating, there was, and I don't even remember what it was, there was some article in mymac.com that I ran across and I'd left a comment.
Ah, yes.
And then you commented back, and then I got an email notification that you had commented. And then I commented back, and pretty soon it's like five or six deep on this article, and we've gone completely off topic from, you know, wherever the conversation started.
Anybody listening to this interview understands that.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. And then you sent me an email and basically said that you liked the way that I wrote, and would I be interested in writing for mymac.com? And I believe that was in 2001. And I'd done some stuff for the Washington Apple Pi. I had actually written a story called The Maltese Cube that I recently updated and published over on Amazon. And it's basically, it's a 15-year-old story, and it really, really reads like a 15-year-old story. it was fun to write, and I think I actually updated it a little bit and also posted it at mymac.com. But that was kind of how I got my start at MyMac. And then you started doing the podcast.
Yeah, in 2004, I started the MyMac podcast. Chad Perry joined me shortly thereafter, around episode 5 or 6 or something, maybe 10, I don't remember. And things are going pretty well for the podcast. I mean, you know, we started podcasting when pretty much when podcasting was invented.
Right, just as it was beginning.
Yeah, and Chad and I had a lot of fun, but we thought it would be fun to have other people contribute as well. In fact, truth be told, I started the My Mac podcast thinking somebody else would eventually take it over because I thought they'd be much better at it than I would be. But I fell in love with it, to be honest.
Yeah.
I fought being labeled as a podcaster for a long time. The My Mac podcast was just an extension of MyMac.com. That's what it was supposed to be, but it became its own entity after a while. People knew that. They didn't know the website, or they knew the website. They didn't know the podcast. And so I believe the very first contributed segment on the My Mac podcast was yours, and that was the Dashboard Minute.
Yeah, the Dashboard Minute, yep. Because 10.4 had just come out.
Yeah, and that introduced widgets to Mac OS X, which I think are going to be gone soon.
Yeah, I will be surprised if it makes it past 10.11.
Yeah, I agree.
But it seemed so cool at the time.
That it, you had it was all
these
cool.
These little mini programs running in a completely different environment.
And for about a year there, it seemed like somebody was coming out with a new widget every day. There was this all kinds of cool widgets. But you know what happened to the widget market? They became apps for the iPhone.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of what they were.
Yeah, little mini applications.
Yeah, there were little games, little weather widgets. I still use them. There's a couple that I still use all the time. There was widgets. One of my favorite, I can't remember the name of it now, would give you multiple clipboards. So you could copy something, bring up that widget, click the little drawer that you wanted to go in, and it would stay there until you brought it back. So you could have three or four things in this widget clipboard, and oh, it was awesome. I loved it.
But there was other software that was apart from Dashboard that filled most of those niches. So widgets became kind of
redundant.
Redundant. There was really no point for them anymore. And I think the very first episode where I did the Dashboard Minute was like episode 34 or 35.
Yeah, it was in the first year of podcasting. So that would have been
2005.
Yeah, 2005. So Guy joins the podcast in, that capacity. He wasn't a host of the show. He just contributed to it.
Yeah.
And then later, at close to the episode that was a big deal for us, which was 100. And remember, this is a weekly podcast. I mean, there's podcasts out there right now that have much higher numbers than the last one that Guy and Gaz just did on the My Mac podcast. But this is a weekly podcast, so that makes a huge difference. It's not daily, Episode 100 was going to be a big deal. And I had talked to Apple about recording this podcast in an Apple store. We decided in Grand Rapids, Michigan, because it, quite honestly, it was the closest Apple store.
Right.
And, we solicited a whole bunch of prizes. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, OWC was part of that as well.
Yes.
They sent some stuff to give away at this live podcast event at the Apple Store. And Chad Perry couldn't make it. He had a family obligation.
Yeah, like at the last minute.
At the last minute. And so Guy Searle flew in from Virginia to West Michigan to join me doing the live podcast.
Well, don't forget, we spent, because Chad was there the night before.
The day Guy flew in, we went and met him. Did we meet you at the airport?
You met me at the airport, took me to my hotel.
That airport, by the way, is completely changed now.
Yeah, that's Gerald R. Ford.
Gerald R. Ford. Yeah, wow, good memory. And we spent hours at Guy's hotel room, and we actually recorded
2 hours.
Podcast. I don't think we ever really used or...
No, you did. Did I? You released that like in 15 to 30 minutes chunks once the 100th episode was over.
and it was a totally different experience. Guy and I doing a live podcast in front of a live audience and giving stuff away. And it was fantastic. And it was right after that Guy became the third host of the My Mac podcast. He joined Chad and I.
Yes.
Eventually, Chad stopped podcasting and it was just me and Guy. Which drove Guy crazy, by the way, because he likes show notes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Topics that we're going to talk about. I wing it.
I'm not a winger.
He's not a winger. And so eventually we brought in a third co-host. That was David Cohen.
Yep.
And the three of us did the podcast for a while. Now, here's the tie into OWC. Guy and I thought it would be really cool to expand the podcast, do something different. So we decided we were going to do a live podcast at Otherworld Computing. They were actually a sponsor of the MyMac podcast at the time. So Guy, once again, flew in to
Chicago. No, I didn't fly in.
Oh, no, you drove. That's right, yeah, you drove.
I did. I actually did a video review of the Navigon app for the iPhone.
Yeah, I still use that app.
GPS app. Yeah, it's a great little app.
I use it. I think I just like the way it looks more than Google or Apple's map. I don't know why.
I agree. Yep.
So Guy and I actually went to OWC and had a tour of the facility, sat down with Larry O'Connor, and it was fantastic. And
except
it was,
we weren't able to actually use the audio.
No, the audio, this room, this conference room that we recorded in, the audio was so bad with the microphones that we used. It was completely unusable. I mean, it was terrible. And which really bummed me out because it was actually a really good interview.
Yes.
And so that gave me the idea, what if OWC had their own podcast? And that was the beginning of OWC Radio. And when I stopped the MyMac podcast, it was to start Otherworld Computing's podcast, OWC Radio.
Right.
At that point, Guy became the host of the show with David. David eventually had to stop, and Gaz moved in shortly thereafter. Mm-hmm. And ever since, so what, 2010? Guy and Gaz has been doing the MyMac podcast for 5 years now.
Yeah, we're actually 585 will be 300 shows.
So that's crazy. So that's the only reason you're listening to this podcast is because me and my guest here, Guy Searle, did a live podcast at OWC, which was never used, and that gave me the idea to pitch to OWC their own show, which I was so happy that they accepted. It's, you know, the first version of OWC Radio, quite honestly, is a different show than what we do now. But it was one of the most rewarding things I had ever done. So if it wasn't for Guy, there would be no OWC Radio. And I'm not being, that's 100% true.
Yeah, 100%. I drive people in various ways.
He drove me away from my own creation. I started... So let me ask you, we're going to get to the three random questions here in a little bit.
Okay.
What is it about podcasting for you that draws you in? Look, you've been doing, you're one of the most old school podcasters in the world at this point, Guy. I mean, there's very few people on this planet who's been podcasting longer than you. Seriously, there's maybe, what, active podcasters right now, maybe
10?
I'd probably say 50.
That are still doing it.
That are still doing it. Okay. I would be one of those rare people because I started the show. But
right.
Adam Christensen is the only other Mac podcast that's been going longer than the MyMac podcast.
Yes.
He started 2 weeks before I did. You're still doing it week in, week out. You're still sitting down with that microphone, firing up Skype, talking to Gaz. You were going to every Macworld Expo and doing podcasts from there until that show ended. You went to the Mac Stock just this last summer and podcasted a couple shows from there. What is it about podcasting that brings you back week in and week out?
I think a lot of it is, and this is going to sound kind of weird, I actually have a fear of public speaking. And the job that I currently have, I have to do some public speaking, and every single time I step up to that podium, I feel like I'm going to wet myself. I'm just so afraid. But podcasting has given me the chance to kind of stretch myself in ways that I could never do in front of a live audience because it's just me here in front of a microphone. I'm not looking at anybody's face. And it gives me the freedom to kind of express myself in ways that you can do through writing, but it doesn't have that sense of
personal.
Yeah. And, well, not so much. Well, you can be very personal in writing.
But not the intimacy of it's actually you.
Yes.
It's your voice, your inflection, right. Your personality.
And to be honest, when the three of us, whether it was Chad or David, were doing the podcast, I was a much different podcaster.
Oh, absolutely.
With you than I've been since I started doing the MyMac podcast with Gaz. And I think part of it is you have a very forceful personality, and you know exactly where it is you're going to go, and you know exactly where it is and how you're going to get there. So when you sit down in front of a microphone, and it's part of the reason why you don't even bother with show notes, because you have all this stuff in your head where you say, okay, well, here's
I've got a lot of stuff in my head, that's for sure.
we're going from point A to point B, and we'll see how many detours we have on the way. Whereas I'm more of a stream of consciousness. You know, it's the same way that I write. It's the same way, kind of the same way that I podcast, where I have notes in front of me to kind of kickstart me in the direction that I want to go. But once I'm going, you know, Johnny bar the door, because I have no idea where my brain is going to take me. And that can be a good thing or a bad thing. It depends on the kind of podcast that you want to listen to. Now, the MyMac podcast was at one point was a much more serious podcast than it is today. I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah, you and Gaz have a lot of fun doing that show. There's a lot of laughs. I mean, the audience that listens to the MyMac podcast, probably there's some carryover, but for the most part, it's a whole different audience back when I was hosting that show.
Well, one of the things that I've told people when it comes to things like podcasting, because, you know, there's not a whole lot of people making money at this. And you know what? I don't care if I ever really make money at it. I mean, it would be nice, but it's not the driving focus of why I do it. I do it because I enjoy it. I do it because I like sitting down in front of a microphone with Gaz each week. And, you know, we've kind of joked around saying that it's like therapy for me, but that's actually probably closer to the truth than I'd like to admit sometimes. It, you know, the regular Joe job that I have can be very stuffy, and it's certainly not creative. It's, you know, it's the same thing in and out all day long. And after doing a job like that for as long as I've been doing it, podcasting is my way of kind of breaking free of that for at least a couple of hours each week.
But you said you have almost a crippling fear of public speaking.
Yes.
And yet you've done very public speaking. I mean, I have the pictures to prove you and I standing on the Macworld's main stage in front of a huge audience.
Yes.
Talking. With yes. No notes.
However, what was the deciding factor in each one of those appearances? That you were there. You set the agenda, and I would follow your lead. And
we did a game show a couple times.
Yeah.
At a couple different Macworlds.
Yeah. And the one I remember really well is the one we did for Spec.
Yeah, we did that. But we also did that one where I had that big screen on the main floor, and we were showing like old icons from programs. Like I would show the Claire's Works icon, just the icon, and I would say, "Okay, what's this one?" And you were in the audience with this huge crowd with a microphone.
Yes.
And you and I would banter back and forth, and you would find the next contestant and talk to them and get them to relax. So I don't know. I've seen you on the main stage or on stage before without me. You and David did a MyMac podcast.
Yeah, but we all know how that didn't go
Yeah, I thought it was good. I enjoyed that
one. Well, the problem...
Do you think you're getting less fearful of public speaking because of podcasting and your experience doing it?
Definitely. Yeah. Like I did MaxDoc last year.
Yeah. Well, this year, technically.
Well, yeah. This year. And I would not have been able to stand there on the stage and give a presentation if it wasn't for podcasting. I talking to Mike Potter. Well, number one, if I wasn't podcasting, Mike Potter never would have heard of me. But even if he had, as a writer, had come to me and said, okay, Guy, I'd like you to do a presentation here.
You had the very first presentation at this MaxDoc event. I sat in the audience and watched you.
And it was fun. It was great. It was so that event was actually the very first time that Gaz and I have met in person. We've been doing this podcast now for 5 or 6 years. And we had never actually met. Now, I'd seen him over, video.
Skype and,
Skype and all the rest of that. But never actually in person. I picked up he and Don McAllister at O'Hare Airport the day before the event.
And they brought me the keyboard I have right here in front of me.
Yeah. The clicky-clacky one.
The clicky-clacky. And that was actually the first time I met Gaz in person as well. And it was historic for the My Mac podcast in that the current hosts, you and Gaz, and me and Chad Perry. I went, and Chad Perry actually went to MacStock with me this year. And we have a couple pictures of the original and the current hosts of the show. That was pretty cool.
That was such a great event.
And we can't make an announcement yet, but Guy and I might be doing something at an event next year. Together.
Huh, I wonder what that might be.
So, Guy Searle.
Yes.
It is time.
Oh, God.
For the eagerly awaited, people are waiting with bated breath. Oh, get to it, come on, you could get to it, Tim. Three random questions.
Okay.
All right, so if this is the first time anyone out there is tuning in to OWC Radio, whenever I have an interview guest, not someone I'm just chatting about the latest and greatest of coming from Apple, like I did with Peter Cohen or Steve Sandy, I have three random questions. I have a big database full of random questions that I found online, various sites. I just paste them into this big database. Well, technically, it's a spreadsheet, not a database. And when I use it, I cross it off and I go to the next three for the next guest. So these questions were not written specifically for Guy Searle. Are you ready?
Just got a drink of water. Yeah, I'm ready.
All right. For $200,000,
ooh,
would you dress up as an Elvis impersonator for all day, every day, for 1 year, going to work everywhere?
Yes, I would. However, I don't think I would have the job after probably the first 3 days.
But you'd still have to keep the.
I would still wear the Elvis outfit. Oh yes, I would for $200,000. Sure. Plus, it would.
I know the answer to the sub question to this would be young skinny Elvis or fat older Elvis.
I think we both know the answer to that one. I need peanut butter and banana sandwich.
Oh, my goodness sakes. I wouldn't have had the follow-up question with anybody else. I guarantee you. Oh, now, this is a good one. This is going to have to make you think for a minute.
Okay.
You are now Michael Bay. The studio has now greenlit you for your next big summer blockbuster based on... And that's the question. What is your Michael Bay? You're going to do this next big summer blockbuster. What's the property it's based on? Look, he's already done. Transformers has been done. G.I. Joe. There's a He-Man coming out.
That's frightening.
I know. That's so frightening. Oh, I remember the last one with Dolph Lundgren. Oh, that was so bad.
Let's see. I'm Michael Bay, and I'm going to do a big summer blockbuster, and the studio is going to give me lots of money no matter what.
Yeah, the franchise that you're picking that you're going to do this giant summer blockbuster on?
Well, this will really show my age, but I would do it on obscure Hanna-Barbera properties.
Really?
Yeah. Secret Squirrel, Peter Potamus, Touche Turtle.
Can you make a Michael Bay based on that?
Sure.
You can. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, pretty much anything.
Yeah, you just throw in some lens flares, you're good.
You know, what I was going to guess that you would say on this? Because I know your age. I listen to the MyMac podcast. I know you. You know what I thought you were going to say?
Tell me.
Thunderbirds.
Thunderbirds are go. Well, that's already been done. Because I was thinking about, well, what live action or, you know, computer-generated right. live action could I do that hasn't already been done? And, you know, they've done Thunderbirds.
Well, I thought Thunderbirds, they redid puppets, though, didn't they?
No. They did it with, oh, God, what's the actor's name? He was one of the punks in the first Terminator movie. He was in Aliens.
Has it already been released?
Oh, years ago.
Really? Thunderbirds. Movie. I remember seeing... Oh, yeah, I guess it has been. Oh, yeah. Oh, Bill Paxton,
that's right.
I've never seen it. Well, 2004.
You are missing absolutely...
But, you know, that's 2004. That's ripe for redoing.
One of the other... But if you're talking about, like, the Super Marionette stuff, which I love. I love all the Super Marionette stuff.
They're so creepy, they were cool.
I know. I would love to see a live action... but done in the same, so you're written so awkwardly way, Captain Scarlet and the Mysterions, Supercar, which was a favorite of mine when I was a little kid. I would love to see them redo. There was a show that I'm talking of. The Super Marionettes are these like big, huge puppets.
Right.
And the guy that did all those shows for ITC, which is over in the UK, is a guy by the name of, I know I'm going to get this wrong, Jerry Anderson, who unfortunately I think passed away a couple years ago. But he also did some live action stuff. He did Space 1999, if you remember that show.
You know what I liked about that show? I love the spaceship itself that would land on the moon.
Oh, the Eagle?
Oh, I love the Eagle. I still think that's one
little,
of the...
Six little rockets.
That yeah. Bottom. That was an awesome looking spaceship.
If you want to see something that's kind of cool done in that same vein, there was one season of a show that Jerry Anderson did called UFO. And it was, they had these girls that were in like these bright, sparkly silver outfits with purple hair. I have no idea why they needed girls with bright, sparkly silver outfits and purple hair on a moon base, but they had them.
But you know the thing about the Eagle? It was a very practical spaceship.
Well, that's what Jerry Anderson did.
I mean, this looks like it could, you know, it was girders and it was ungainly looking. It wasn't sleek or fast like the Millennium Falcon or a Viper from Battlestar Galactica. This is something that NASA would have been building in the 70s.
Do a search real quick for UFO interceptor.
Oh, good Lord knows what I'm going to get. UFO... Interceptor. Space station?
No. And it's got what looks like a great big torpedo on the front of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I found it.
My father used to travel over to the Caribbeans as
almost disturbing.
One of the jobs that he had. He got me a Corgi model of this little spaceship. And on the Corgi model, you hit this button and the little torpedo would fire off. So it was a really, really cool model. And they also had...
You still have it?
They had, no, God, no. I wish I did.
Was it green or was it the white one?
The white one.
Yeah.
They also had this submarine that had an airplane on the front of it. So if the UFO managed to get past the interceptors on the moon base, this submarine would go up close to the surface, but not quite surface, fire off this airplane... That would break the plane of the water and then take off and try to intercept the UFO. But it was a really cool show.
It was Marionette. Oh, there's the submarine. No. Oh, that submarine was pretty cool looking too.
Yeah, isn't it? This was live action.
Like we said, you never know the direction.
Well, what's the third question?
The third question and the final question for Guy Searle's three random questions. By the way, next time we have Guy Searle back, it's not going to be an interview. We're just going to have a chat with Guy about something going on in the world.
Ooh.
Number three, you have to be a supervillain. Which supervillain are you? And you know, here's the thing. Guy Searle used to collect comic books. Or do you still collect comic books?
I don't get the individual issues anymore.
Trade paperbacks?
I get trade paperbacks now. Yeah. It's I just don't have the time to
I've got
I still have like over 50 long boxes.
Yeah, I've got
all bagged and everything.
Yeah, I'm getting rid of my comic book collection.
Nobody wants to buy them
anymore. I know, that's the problem. I never bought them thinking they were ever going to be really worth any money.
No, I just liked reading them.
I did too, but I get them on my iPad now.
70s.
Yeah, so did mine.
Yeah. But supervillains.
Yeah, you got to be a supervillain.
Got to be a supervillain.
Doesn't Marvel, DC, Valiant, whatever. Which supervillain are you? And of course, the follow-up question will be why. Why that one?
Okay. Well, I don't think I'd want to be like a dark side or anything like that. That's, you know, that's too easy. I think.
I mean, you have like a so when you say dark side, you mean like a Joker?
No. Dark side, like the DC cosmic villain.
Oh, okay. Oh, dark side. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I heard a slight pause between dark and side, like dark side, like the Force or.
No. Dark side. Dark side.
No. Well, no, because I mean. He's too alien, almost too powerful. What's his motivation? He's in a perpetual war with the new gods. It's kind of boring. I mean, you got Thanos. You've got the Joker.
Nah, I don't want. I wouldn't want to be the Joker because he's just too random.
Yeah, he's insane.
Yeah. The two that come off the top of my head are both from Marvel, and they're both Spider-Man villains: Doc Ock and the Vulture. And it would be really hard.
I could see Doc Ock because I think it would be really cool just to have all these different arms that you can control and
you'd
be way
fat.
Up in the air and you're kind of, you know, climbing buildings and stuff. I don't get the Vulture though.
He flies.
Well, yeah, but a lot of them fly.
I know. It just something about or another Spider-Man villain, Kraven the Hunter.
Yeah, he'd be cool. He'd be cool. I was thinking more like Lex Luthor.
Because then
you get the best of Tony Stark.
The problem with guys like that is they become so focused on the hero.
And they used to. I mean, look what Marvel did with Harry Osborn, the Green Goblin, a couple years ago. They made him basically the Lex Luthor of the Marvel Universe. They didn't keep him that way for long, unfortunately. But he had everyone hoodwinked. That's one of the ultimate villains. They're doing that kind of with Lex Luthor right now. He's a member of the Justice League. I mean,
I haven't been collecting. Well, the ever since they did the whole New 52 thing.
Yeah, I know.
In the DC Universe. Ruined it. And I understand why they did it because the problem with companies like DC and Marvel, and Marvel now has got the same issue. Is you get so much backstory.
It was never a problem when you and I were a kid, and they were going for 25 years, 30 years before that. It was never a problem, you know, 20 years ago or 10 years ago. Why is it a problem now? I understand if you want to fix, you know, the Punisher wasn't in Vietnam. He was in, you know, Desert Storm. Okay, fine. Otherwise, he'd be in his 60s now.
Yeah.
I can understand tweaking stuff like that. I don't understand this need to reboot, trying to get in new readers. I think it's disingenuous. It's all gimmicks. Simply, they're going to have a big relaunch. They're going to have a new Captain America. You know Steve Rogers is eventually going to take it back. You know, Wolverine's dead. He's going to come back. Superman's dead. He's going to come back. Captain America's dead. He's going to come back. They always do these things, but they don't really...
This changes everything.
Yeah, and it doesn't. No. Leave it. Be proud of the history of your comics and in these things. I know this is way off topic, but this is what happens sometimes.
Well, I can tell you in one word: continuity.
Yeah.
The audience that comic book companies had in the 60s and 70s is not the same audience that started reading comic books in the 80s, 90s, and aughts. In the 80s, 90s, and aughts, you get, when I was reading comic books, it was like, ooh, okay, let me see what the Joker's going to do to the Batman this week, mm-hmm. you know, and whatever the Joker did, he would, you know, they'd cart him off to Arkham, or he would disappear. Oh, Joker's dead, but you know, he's not really dead, kind of thing. But when he showed up again, there was no mention of anything he did before. There was no question of continuity, because it just didn't matter. It was 1, 2, 3 issue story arcs, and when that story arc was done, it no longer was an issue. You know, nobody thought about it anymore.
Well, that changed in the 60s, though. Marvel and Stan Lee changed that. But let's end this, though, because otherwise this is going to turn into a comic book, and we're going to bore 99.9% of those listening. So it's either Doc Ock or the Vulture for you.
Yes.
Guy Searle, I want to thank you for coming on OWC Radio this week. It was our pleasure to have you.
I love doing it.
You know, we're going to have you back on the show and talk about Apple and what's been going on. You did say, though, before we wrap up, you did say you're going to pick up this new iPad Pro.
Yes.
Yeah. Why the Pro instead of just an Air?
A bigger screen, for the most part. I have wanted a bigger screen iPad practically since I bought my third gen. I had a first gen, and it was great. Bought the third gen. That was great. I was doing all kinds of stuff with it. The last two Macworld Expos, I didn't even take a laptop. I did everything off of iOS devices. But I felt really, really constrained just because of screen real estate and trying to do stuff. And plus, I'm, you know, as
multitasking,
you know,
you can't do that.
Well, it's not even so much multitasking. I'm a rather large individual.
Yeah, you're
very
what,
tall.
6'6".
I have really big hands, and trying to manipulate stuff with touch on a 9-inch screen, that can get really, really tough.
Now, are you looking at Apple's keyboard cover, or
no,
are you looking at?
I do not want Apple's. I think that keyboard is atrocious.
Yeah, I heard some early reports about the Magic Pencil that it's really impressive.
I did see the keynote, and I enjoyed what they showed, and I was watched in awe with what those artists were doing. But I have absolutely no need for it mm-hmm. at all. I want a keyboard that uses the new Apple connector that's on the side mm-hmm. of the iPad Pro. And I know Logitech, along with a few other companies.
Yeah, Logitech just announced something this week.
Yeah, yeah. I've got a Logitech Bluetooth keyboard for my iPad 3 and love it. As a matter of fact, I have another Logitech full-size keyboard that's Bluetooth that I use when I'm doing more, he said, with quotation marks, serious writing.
I've got a Zag one that I picked up like 3 years, 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And it kind of looks like an Apple keyboard. It's aluminum,
mm-hmm.
rechargeable, all that. And it's Bluetooth, and it's got a little slot. And it fits my newest iPad, which is an iPad Air 2, as well as my very first one, the original iPad.
Yep.
I've used it 4 times.
I use mine all the time, the keyboard. When I'm out and about and all I have is my iPad, I will write and type and all the rest of that on my Logitech keyboard with my iPad.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to a new iPad Pro. I'm going to get the 128 with cellular. So I'll have connectivity all the time. I will look around and see what the best Apple-connected keyboards are. I don't want to go... I mean, I could easily go with a Bluetooth keyboard, but that doesn't really interest me. I want something where I don't have to worry about power and charging and all the rest of that. But I do not want Apple's Surface... sorry, excuse me. I don't want Apple's keyboard that they showed for the iPad Pro.
I'm on the fence about the iPad Pro, to be honest. I look, less than a year ago, I picked up the brand new 64 gig iPad Air 2. And
right.
I did upgrade it to OS 9 today. As we record this, iOS 9 came out. I upgraded my iPhone 6 Plus. No problem. Everything was buttery smooth. Everything's working just the way it did before.
Yep.
I briefly played with split screen on my iPad. That was the thing that had me the most excited. But it's too early for me to say if it's worth it to me yet or not. But that being said, this thing is so fast and does everything I want it to do. I don't really have a burning need to get an iPad Air 2.
The only reason that you would have to update to an iPad Pro would be for the bigger screen.
You know, and for my use cases,
right, exactly.
You know, I consume on my iPad. I don't create.
Well, I've done a lot of both.
Yeah. You know. Anyways, Guy Searle, where can people find you online?
Well, you can find me, of course, over at the MyMac.com podcast, which I do nearly every week with the infamous Gazmaz. We have a really, really good time. I tell people that the MyMac podcast is the technology podcast for people that don't like technology. You can also find me on Twitter. My handle there is MacParrot, as well as contacting me via email over guy@mymac.com. And we have a Skype number that has continuously been ignored for nearly 6 years, and that Skype number is 703-436-9501. Call it collect, call it direct, but call it today. Yeah.
For those who want to upgrade their Mac, make sure you're going to MacSales.com, RAM.
Love the Mac sales.
An SSD. You need external storage. You need to plug things more. You need to plug more things into your Mac. How about a Thunderbolt 2 dock? I mean, you have all the expansion you could ever want. Maybe you got one of the brand new MacBooks. You got the one port on there. What do? Well, we've got a USB-C dock coming out very soon. Check that out at MacSales.com as well. And we'll see you in a week.